Okay, so I thank you. I guess the general theme is, what do we do with all this expression data? And I think there's no unique answer to that, but here's one try. Let me just first, well, Kim wanted this, told me I should give a Blackboard talk, and I feel this is like, you know, Springsteen being asked to play Unplugged. Well, I actually did see Springsteen play MTV Unplugged once, and he only played the first number acoustic. So maybe I'll write one equation. But I seem to be plugged in, but not amplified. Anyway. So I'll just tell you about the data that we happen to have, what it's about, and tell you how we try to analyze it and see whether we can learn something from it. So these are not really array data. This is a toy version of that. This is, but you can imagine that it was just a more accurate than usual set of array data. Its expression levels on about 100 genes in neural development in the rat, measured one set of measurements in the spinal cord and one in the hippocampus. And they're at 9 times before and after birth. And these data, probably a number of you have seen. They come from the lab of Roland Shomogy, who was then at the NIH. And this is not terribly, well, anyway, this is just what the data look like. So if you, the names of the different genes are over here on the left, and they're classified in some biologically meaningful way. And the first column says E11. So that's 11 days after conception. And then there's another measurement 2 days later, 2 days after that, 3 days after that, 3 days after that. Postnatal 0, that's the day of birth. I think that's actually the same as 22, so it's only a day after the previous measurement. Then a week later, 2 weeks later, and the final measurement is the adult rat. Okay, so the darkness here represents the strength of the expression, the mRNA concentration.
Each cell is a different rat or a different collection of rats?
Well, to do the experiment, yeah, it's not the same rat. The rat only survives one measurement.
It could have been a collection over which you added.
Yes.
There
were
small embryos.
Yeah.
to put together several grains.
So that's what I was asking about. How many?
I think these are averages over 3.
Uh-huh.
But okay. So you can see different temporal patterns in the way they get dark and bright here. Here's one which is highly expressed in the embryonic thing and then falls off to nothing. There are others which not much happens to them until well after birth. There's various temporal patterns for all of these things. This is actually half the data. And just for completeness, this is the other half. I guess it's the spinal cord data you're looking at right here. The details would be different for the measurements taken in hippocampus, but this gives you the idea. And you can see the kinds of proteins that one is talking about in different cases. These were selected by Roland as having some putative relevance to neural development.
On the same embryo, you're able to do multiple enzymes.
Yes.
It's typically the way, so you get one sample infection that comes from a particular tissue from a particular time. You can make RNA from that. You can array that. You can spread this over thousands of different genes that are arrayed. This is just a sample. So you can make as many genes as you wish.
Yeah. But actually, I mean, these measurements weren't made with an array. They're just taken. You divide the sample up and amplify each emma. Yes, just PCR. Yeah. Okay.
Each point is a test tube.
Yeah.
A little more complex.
Big measurements. Okay. Now, what do we want to do with this? There's obviously some dynamics going on in development, and we'd like to see if we can learn something from all these data. And naturally, what we have in mind is some kind of network picture. And somewhere I have a graph of a network. Where did it go? Well, we'll use this graph. All right, these pictures are just something like you've seen many times, just to remind you that genes control each other's expression, and what's responsible ultimately for the rises and falls in expression levels is something happening in the regulatory regions of those genes, which is controlled by the expressions of other genes and so on. So we take a completely phenomenological picture of this and try and write a simple kinetic model to describe what's going on this very slow time scale. Okay, so I emphasize we're not doing chemical kinetics here. Right, so don't ask me for the Hill coefficient and things like that, because that would be an inappropriate level of detail to be talking about here. So here we're doing phenomenology on a much longer time scale. So what I just say is that I make the assumption that the concentration of one of these species, well, there's a relaxation time associated with it due to degradation of one kind or another. And what's making it grow depends on the activities of the other species, weighted with some coefficients. In the simplest model that you can make, you just stop right here and say it's some function, maybe in the simplest case a linear function of the weighted activities of the other things. So this coefficient jij tells you how strongly the expression level of gene number j affects the transcription of gene number I. Okay. And of course, this is not the most general model. And you could, in principle, add all higher order terms, of which you see the first one here. And the trouble is, with the amount of data that we have, we don't have a chance of pinning down many of these things. Although when you write down simple rate equations at a more microscopic level, you obviously see things like this coming in from protein-protein interactions. I left out of here a constant term, which I then wrote in by hand, just to remind you that in the absence of other things, or for the other things held constant, different genes are going to have different transcription rates. So the degree of tendency toward constitutive transcription, that's represented by this factor. What? Because you need to also describe decay. Right, so this side gives sort of the target, what level of expression things are going to, and this tells you how fast it's getting there. Okay, so that's another parameter of the model.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, all right, G, the output thing, G here, tells you what the, whether the thing is on or off.
I guess at this point there's probably a choice whether to include mRNA levels in the variables or not. You haven't said, as you said, what the S, what the class
of. Well, the S's are supposed to be the mRNA levels, because that's what we're measuring. In, no, I mean, you could write down the same kind of model. Maybe it's even a more appealing interpretation if you think of the S's as the protein concentrations. And but anyway, we just approach this phenomenologically and say basically, we assume that the concentrations of one species of mRNA is dependent in this way on the concentration of the others. But you need to put in some relaxation as well. Okay, so it's just pure phenomenology. But we just want to see if we can get something out of that. So I just want to emphasize one thing. This is a picture which I got from Roland, which pictures the important variables, dynamical variables in the cell. Yeah.
Just look at this previous equation. Suppose you take something very simple, that there is only one Sj other than Si on which the left side of the equation depends. On the right hand side, there is only one Jij, the linear term is non zero, and that's it. What kind of behavior do you get? This is a very strange equation. I don't understand what you're going to get out of this.
All right, let me go back.
Just to give us an intuition of what kind of mathematical behavior.
Now, what?
Suppose that there are two species, one and two.
Yeah.
On
okay.
The left, I equals one.
Yeah.
And there is only one ij which is different than zero, which is for S2.
For j equal two.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you get?
Well, then, but what about the equation for S2?
Let's talk first about one. What is the time behavior that you expect from an equation like this?
Okay, well, I expect that in that case, depending on how much S2 is present, if it's big enough so that G is large, I haven't said so. G is a function. Okay, and in the simplest model, you can just leave out the G and just assume it's a linear relation.
Okay.
But what I use is a sigmoidal G just to keep things from being too big or too small. Okay, so that's just a sigmoid squashing on this. And so if there's a big concentration of S2 in that case, and the J12 is positive, and the B is not strongly negative, right, then this G will rise up near its saturation value, right? Oh, yeah, so there should be a around there, okay?
both the parenthesis and the bracket include the same thing.
Yeah, maybe that's, maybe, let's erase that, okay? Sorry, all the times I've given this talk, I never noticed that. Okay, so is this just a notational problem? Okay, so when the G, the argument of G is big, then G gets up near 1, and that says that S will be approaching its maximum value, which I define to be 1 by normalization, will be approaching it exponentially with a relaxation time tau sub 1. Okay, if S is too small, so that G, so that the net argument of G is negative, then basically S will be relaxing towards 0 with the same relaxation time.
So this tau is actually a typical time for the response of one gene to the concentration of the other, one messenger to
right.
the concentration of the other.
Right.
I never write something like that, so I'm puzzled. Usually I either write the SVT equals to something on the right, or I write S equals to something on the right, but this is strange.
Ah, okay. Okay, so maybe it's good we took time to clear that up.
If everything is normalized to 0 and 1, the relaxation time for synthesis or the evolution.
That what is?
The relaxation time for synthesis and for the evolution is the same.
Yeah, in this model, there's only one tau. Yeah. Again, I wanted to use as few parameters as possible. Okay, so I just wanted to say, just to perspective on what we're modeling here. So there's a whole lot of dynamical variables left out of this, which you would put in at the level of really trying to do chemical kinetics. But I take a kind of renormalization group view of this thing, and we're looking at the really slow, long time behavior. So we're looking really at some kind of infrared effective theory, you would say, in physics. And the interactions between the variables that we have, well, to get those interactions, we've integrated out all sorts of faster things. You know, from this perspective, talking about the binding of a transcription factor to DNA and matching the residues against each other, you know, this is Planck-like physics for us. We're really working in the trying to characterize phenomenologically what happens to these very slow variables. Well, certainly phosphorylation and all this kind of thing that these things are doing, that's faster than day. Okay, well, the measurements we have are on the day time scale. So some of this stuff at least is faster. Now, of course, as our G expression levels are changing, protein levels are also changing. But the question is whether they contain extra information that isn't in the variables that we keep. And all we can do is just make a hypothesis. Let's try this from the data that we can get and see if it tells us something useful. Okay. Okay. So now you've seen the data, and there's one thing which will certainly have occurred to you. In each time series, we have on the order of 10 measurements per gene, and that's sufficient to fix at most that many parameters. But if we have 100 genes, and you can see this problem gets even worse if we go to arrays where we have thousands of genes, you have, even in this restricted model where we only look at the linear coefficients, the Jijs, we have 10 times as many unknowns as we have data points. And even worse, that these 10 measurements aren't all independent, they're on the same trajectory. So the problem's even worse. However, there is one way out, and that's to do some coarse graining in gene space. We've already coarse grained a lot in time, and actually the guys who took the data took this first step for us, and you've probably heard some of this in previous talks.
Are you assuming also influences across time space? Because this was not in your equation. That is, that the gene at time E17 influences what happens to a gene at E21.
No, each time step only influences the next time step. Right. It's a first-order differential equation, which we'll approximate by discretizing at the day level. Well, those Jijs, for each I, there are 100 values of J, 100 other genes.
Okay, for each I.
Yeah. I mean, I gave those numbers there one gene at a time, but for the whole set, just multiply by n. Okay, so they discovered empirically that the way these expression levels rose and fell wasn't just everything. They clustered at least approximately into five groups. So here's their clustering tree. One of those clusters is things which didn't change much, and they're not interesting to us. So there's only four others. There's an early wave, hope you can see this, of ones which, this is the average behavior of ones in this cluster, which...
How is this tree?
You mean which clustering algorithm?
Yeah.
I actually don't remember, but I don't care. We tried several.
This is for each gene, you've got a vector of the time points. And they just give correlation coefficients between the vectors. Mm-hmm. And then from that, Euclidean distances between the vectors. And then that gives you pairwise distances from which they go to the tree.
Okay, so the genes in cluster number one tended to peak real early and then fall off. Genes in cluster number two came up a little bit later and tended to stay up. Genes in cluster number three came up even later than these and then tended to fall off. And genes in cluster number four just tended to rise during the whole thing. Okay. And, you know, I think you could do the clustering in slightly different ways, but basically you'd probably always wind up identifying clusters that rose and fell qualitatively, something like that. So here's the that time development that I showed you in the little pictures, drawn with some splines between them for the different clusters. And they actually, you know, went, looked and saw which ones were in the different clusters, and there's some biological meaning to this. The ones at the beginning are associated with the immature proliferative stages. These were various aspects of neurogenesis.
Arrow bar is on the right point here.
What?
A typical arrow bar, because this is an average of many members of the cluster.
Yeah. I guess if you look at the spread within the cluster, it's maybe plus minus 0.1 or something. Yeah, we'll look at these again. have I got them? Yeah, all right, I lack the crucial transparency. But, well, I'll have to just put one of these back. Now, here are the expression patterns the way I showed them to you before, where they're just classified functionally like this, and you can read the time dependence across for each gene. If you group them into clusters, and that's the transparency I forgot, it is rather striking the way the different clusters, within the cluster, they resemble each other pretty well. So you would see a whole set of rows here that sort of column by column look pretty close. So there is some
surprise.
I don't know whether to be surprised or not. I just mentioned that that's what they found. Okay.
The alternative would have been that the tree would be very rigid, that every branch would be on its own, and that they group together tests some kind of concerted behavior within certain groups of genes.
Yeah.
It's a little bit in the eyes of the beholder, depending on how much you believe your cluster and algorithm and the separation of the subtrees. But if you had been able to show us the data, and we saw it with our own eyes how similar with the group they are, then we'd be a surprise. But when you take a very complex organism, each gene could take its own course.
Yeah. But maybe there's also something to the selection of the genes that they chose to measure. Okay, so so now if we use these cluster averages, now we're just down to 4 units in our network instead of 100. And we can try and fit this model, which I write here again, and try and find the parameters, the J's. Well, these used to be called B's, but the constants in there, and the tau's. And you know, now it looks, well, let's count how much data we have. we left out the adult one, so we actually have, there were 8 points left. So that's 7 steps from Ti to Ti plus 1. So that's the number of data points. And the number of parameters, well, there's 4 of the Jij's because there are 4 clusters, and there's 1 bias. And I left out the time constant tau, so this should really say 6, not 5. So it looks like you have slightly more data than parameters. However, what you find is it's still still is not enough. But here I showed just an example of how you can, using the genetic algorithm, find some coefficients in here. And then you can run that network and get the solid curves here, and you can see that you can roughly match the data. The trouble is you can run the genetic algorithm again, find another set that also works, and so, for example, just trying to fit on one of these time series, I ran the genetic algorithm several hundred times, and so what you see in each of these is for each of the parameters, the weights Jij, a histogram of the values found in all the different runs. Now all these runs were runs which achieved an error below the threshold that basically was set by the accuracy of the data. Okay, so you see that these things are spread out all over the place, and except for one or two here and there, there's no visible systematic tendency. So these data are at this point looking at one of these time series at a time, not very helpful. So that, I guess that one was for the hippocampal data. This one is for the spinal cord.
This is a distribution for well, it's a probability distribution for different values for a given parameter. Is that what you're showing?
Yeah, I run the.
What's on the x-axis? I just can't see.
All right, the x-axis is the values of the parameters between the ranges that we allowed it to have.
And the y-axis is its propensity in different.
And the y-axis is how often we found values in bins along this axis. So
that fit the data.
What?
That fit the data
of the two, well, of the one time series, right? Of the four clusters.
Only 10 discrete solutions, because you show nothing about the correlations between them, such as, for example, if J11, very low value, always was with J43, very high value, you wouldn't see it.
I'll get to that. It's true, you wouldn't see it here. We've also looked at two-dimensional histograms, and sometimes there's something interesting in that. But at least with the amount of data that we have, most of the information is at the single parameter level.
In a system that has, let's say, 7 fixed points with some noise, you would see that. But still there are 7 fixed points. This data doesn't show. I mean, 7 different 16 long vectors of values, just those and nothing else, plus a little bit of noise, you would see a set of distributions like this. And you would never, by looking at that, you would never be able to say that there are relatively few fixed points.
Now, I'm not sure what you mean by fixed point.
Never mind.
But
solutions. Good solutions.
Okay, so acceptable sets of J's, right?
Yeah.
Okay, all I can say is we can look for acceptable sets of J's using this algorithm as best we can. And we find widely varying values, and all I can do is show you, just as an example, how these values distribute themselves empirically. Okay. Yeah. But it's clear that at this level you can't see much. Yeah, we've looked at some of these things, and there are a couple of examples of, say, anti-correlated pairs of parameters.
But you want to do it systematically. What you have each time that you run the genetic algorithm, you get a vector of 16 numbers, right?
Yeah.
If you took all of these vectors and you did, say, principal component analysis on them, you might be seeing clusters in 16-dimensional space reduced to fewer dimensions so as to be visible easily by a human observer. But you could see some kind of the method here. That just showing the histograms is almost like not showing nothing.
Okay, we have done something like this. And we weren't able to see anything very interesting in it. Now, it may be a sampling problem. In high dimensionality, we maybe should have run even more runs of made the computer work harder. So this is not finished yet, but this is just what you get at a first look at it. But the somewhat better news is that when you combine the two series, right, you assume the same model except for different biases, those parameters B, the same model applies to both things. That gives you twice as much data, roughly. And sorry? Well, you have one time series for hippocampal development, one time series for spinal cord development.
What was the previous?
The previous two you saw were for the two things, spinal cord and hippocampus, separately. Okay, so now we're making an assumption here, which is to be tested, namely that it's the same dynamics being played out in both tissues. Right, and we allow, of course, the tissues are different, and we allow that by letting those bias parameters, the Bs or Hs, whatever you call them, be different in the two tissues. So that costs you one more parameter per gene, but you have twice as much data now. Okay, and now when you do the same thing and analyze it in this admittedly crude way, you see that some of the parameters are still not so well fixed, but some of them tend to push up against their boundaries pretty hard. Right? So J31, the strength with which cluster 1, the early peakers, drives cluster 3, that's one of the second wave to come after that, that's a strongly positive effect. And that's, I would argue that the fact that that's piled up against the maximum possible value there tells you that that's a pretty robust effect. So you can, when you get a little bit more data, two time series instead of one, you can start to see something systematic and draw a few robust conclusions. Some of these parameters are now apparently reasonably well fixed. Now, the fact that they're leaning up against the maximum values that we allowed them to have in the search suggests, well, maybe we ought to increase the size range that they are allowed to be found in. And so I doubled that in this case, let it take an absolute value maximum of 10 instead of 5 in the units that we had. And again, what you see is that these histograms, if you compare this with the previous one, they spread out a bit, but the ones that were found to be strongly positive or strongly negative, like here and here, remain pretty much that way. Okay. Now, if I go back to, how am I doing in time? Okay. I go back to my original equation. Well, here's one version of it. You see, there's a certain unfortunate uncertainty in all this. Suppose we found some sets of H's and J's that worked, as we found in a number of these cases, then suppose we just doubled them all, right? So we're just increasing the argument of this sigmoid function by a factor of 2. Well, that's like making the sigmoid twice as sharp. So going to really strong weights, but with the same set of which ones are positive and which ones are negative, all that's going to do is make the transition from S approaching 1, when the argument here is positive, to S decaying down towards 0. It's going to make that a sharp transition. And in fact, the example I showed you here, this is one which was taken with actually very, really big weights. And so what you can see here is this initially, the argument of its G function for cluster number 1 was initially positive, so this was an exponential approaching 1 initially, but at this time point here, due to the change in the others, the argument of G fell below 0, and it started exponentially approaching back down towards zero. So you can see that the solutions we got in these cases are just always, except for a little bit of rounding around the corners, are always pieces of exponentials approaching one or zero. And I mean, you can say that this is artificial. We don't really believe the expression levels change slope abruptly like that. But if our only criterion is fitting the data, there's nothing to nothing in the data. You have to put that criterion in separately. Okay. So, so the lesson of that is any set of J's that works, if you keep the sign relations among them, and you can make them much bigger, and you'll wind up with curves like this, which fit the data just about as well as the...
Why in the lower left do you have a change in the slope from positive, negative to positive when the data do not seem to have such a change?
You mean here?
Yeah. Why not go upward?
Well, it must have been that initially the net activities driving this second cluster in the model were below threshold. And so there was an initial decay, but then it's getting input, say, from this one, which is rising, and from this one too. And so after a couple days, the input is above threshold, and it starts to rise like that.
Is this fully converted, or is it stopped once you get moving the error bar?
We always stop within some error bars.
Okay. So probably you continue to optimize as much of the error as possible, all the things
Yeah, this is possible. It's just that the error bars on these things don't justify going. Yeah. I mean, this is just one example.
You say that this is a fit that takes into account all four behaviors together?
Yeah.
So it's an optimal set of parameters that will explain four different behaviors together. So another comment parallel to what you just said is that if you do a fit for four different behaviors, then even if you went all the way to the best fit, there still wouldn't be an exact fit to each and every one of the time series.
No, okay, well, I mean, understand, four different behaviors, it's four different clusters.
It's four different time series.
It's two different time series. Well, one was in hippocampus and one was in spinal cord. Oh, you can, okay, it's eight, it's, yeah, two times four, right. Yeah, and you're jointly trying to optimize the whole thing.
So you're bound to see some deviations, such as
yeah.
But on individual.
Yeah. But sort of that's not the point. The point is that there's a whole lot of combinations of parameters that work well enough within the realistic error criterion.
The answer to one is that just that you don't expect the lines, the drawn lines, to follow faithfully the experimental.
No.
Optimal solution with some.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So anyway, there's this proviso that I can't fit the magnitudes. You know, there's a degeneracy up to an overall scaling of things for the reasons I just outlined, but I can at least get a good idea of some of the parameters. Which ones are strongly positive and which ones are strongly negative. Maybe something about their relative.
Did this they're cycles, that you make something better, and when you make something better than the previous one, when you were hoping to converge by the time you quit to that some optimal, nearly optimal value.
Okay, the fitting method is called genetic algorithm. So you actually start with a family of potential solutions, and you combine them in different ways and make, right, and evolve the population until you've got a good population.
So how many, we called each one of those a generation, how many generations did you evolve?
Oh, hundreds, but I can't remember. You just run the computer.
Did you quit because you ceased to get a certain amount of improvement?
Well,
what was the stopping rule?
We looked at how uncertain the data were to begin with. So all the initial measurements had a roughly 10% uncertainty associated with them. Because we, remember I told you, we had them on three animals every time. So that gives you some idea of the uncertainty. And then there's also the uncertainty that you should assign to the cluster variable, right? The variation within the cluster, that's of the same order of magnitude. So that sets an error criterion for us. It says there's no point in trying to fit much better than that degree of uncertainty. So basically, well, you can play with the parameters a little bit. When we get to fits that are that good or a little bit better, we stop. But we do this many times to try and get an idea generically what the overall population is like. Okay. So, does that answer your question? Okay, so if I just take the parameters that are well fixed by this, I can actually draw a little network that sort of describes what's going on for the four clusters. So just to describe the two of these clusters, the first and the last are rather slow in their dynamics, and the second and third are faster, so the time constants are factor of three or four shorter. And let's see, just look at some of these things. One was the one that started out high or rose early and then fell. And what we found tells you sort of, well, what is it that's driving it down? And it seems that the answer, which comes from the looking at the robust features of the solution, is that it's being driven down by signals from cluster 2 and cluster 4, but not cluster 3.
The color corresponds to the sign?
Right. The red means that it's repressive, and the green means that it's facilitative. Okay. Sorry for colorblind people. Let's see, there's other features. Number 4, for example, it's being driven up. It's the one which rises slowly, and you can see it gets positive input from the others. And it would go up even faster, except that it actually inhibits itself. So these features, which you can read off of this, or which you can read off of the histograms by looking closely, are things which were not obvious from looking at the data. So we've got at this kind of coarse-grained level, where we've coarse-grained by, not only by looking at whole tissues, but by clustering the genes within the tissue. And again, looking at this very slow time scale, this gives us a qualitative picture of kind of what's happening in these dynamics. Who's driving whom up and down? And of course, you don't know about which genes in here are responsible for this and the microscopic mechanism. That's something not available to us looking on this level of resolution. But I argue that the coarse grain kind of macroscopic picture is also an interesting, important one to have. So that's basically the story. I just will put the put this one back on here one more time, just to show again a basic qualitative feature of what's happening here. If I run a diagonal here, what you can see is the ones down here below the diagonal tend to be positive. This. Okay. And the ones on the other side tend to be negative. Like this. Well, that's on the diagonal. So what that says is, which should come as no surprise, is that crudely speaking, the way you can describe this is that the ones in every cluster facilitate the expression of the ones that come later, and then once they have, expressed, they repress the they repress the expression of the ones that were peaking earlier. It's a kind of coherent set of waves, one after the other, and each one is helping to make the following one happen and to turn off the ones, the earlier ones that preceded it. So that's the picture we can get at this point.
Suppose you were to take some of these parameters here that look to be not very important, that is, a mean value of zero, and eliminate those, so you now reduce the size of the parameter space and see if you get a more consistent set of solutions.
That's what we did here. Then the other parameters tend to sharpen up, as you can see. So these were the ones which we sort of set to zero, and the others are now even better determined than they were before. And I think there's a general question of, scientific philosophy about this. What is it you're trying to infer here? We did this, and this is part of asking for sort of what's the minimal model that fits the data. And a minimal model is better if it has fewer parameters, so we've thrown out the ones that we didn't find were well determined. But I think, at least I take a more fundamentalist view and say that this is the one we should look at. What the data are telling us is that some parameters are relatively well determined and others are not. And if we look back on what we've done, initially we had this set of parameters that we had total ignorance of. So imagine a box in J space. All we know is that the network is somewhere in that box. The probability density of the network is a uniform cloud in there initially. And now, afterwards, this cloud, what we can say on the basis of this data is that we can compress this cloud rather anisotropically, compress it rather strongly in some directions. Because if we look through the end of the box, take the cross-section along one of the directions, like this one, we see the weight is all piled up around one end of it. Right, so these are looking through different ends of the box in different projections of this highly anisotropic many-dimensional thing. So I think that is the answer at the basic level, at least as I understand it, that this is what we've learned, right? We haven't learned everything. Some of these things are still spread out. But we've learned that some parameters are well fixed. I will also mention, I guess the question was raised already. This is just looking at one of them at a time, but of course we could look at pairs of them at a time, or various combinations, various other linear combinations, see what the distribution in this space is like. We've tried this, and the only interesting things we saw in these data was that there were a couple examples of, I can't remember what they were, of pairs. Maybe it was one of these and one of the bias terms, which were negatively correlated. Right, so what that's saying is that maybe, let's take one of these which is positive. It says that number 4 is going up. Partly because it's being driven by number 1. But maybe it also just has a natural tendency, it may be a constitutive tendency toward expression, which is also going up. And you could fit it just as well by removing one of these and increasing the bias instead. Right? And if the data are equivocal, maybe you can't tell the difference in this problem between those things. I don't remember which example it was, but in the paper that we wrote, we mentioned a couple examples of that. So we could find a few examples where, by looking at joint statistics for pairs of these parameters, there was a little bit extra that we could add. But the zeroth order story that we can see is what you get here. Okay. Thank you.
When you do the genetic algorithm, do you always start with the same values for the parameter?
No, we do a whole bunch of runs with different seeds. I mean, it's a stochastic algorithm, and you know, there's a random number generator used in the middle of it.
I mean, if it's a space with lots of hills and valleys, you may drive yourself up a local peak.
Yeah, but then if you try it with a different seed, you presumably aren't going to find the same local peak.
Does what? It determines which things you, which values you're assigning or reassigning, taking changing some of the parameters.
Well, it determines the initial values. I guess there's actually several seeds in there.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. I see what you mean. Okay.
But,
the initial population is broad,
right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the way I think of what you have here, in genetic algorithms were invented in order to, you know, help you get out of local local suboptimal solutions and try and find the real best solution. But here, their virtue is something a little bit different. I mean, the problem is, well, let's see. Since I'm a physicist, I always think of these things upside down, trying to lower the energy. Think of the cost function as an energy. So rather than hill climbing, it's coming down into the valley. And it's kind of like a mountain landscape. You know, there are lots of bad solutions, namely the tops of the mountains and so on. But there's also a lot of river valleys. And within a river valley, things can be quite flat. And so the problem with the dumbest kind of algorithms that you could try, which we tried first, namely just sort of sliding downhill or maybe sliding downhill with a little noise, is the step size, what maybe is a good step size for when you're coming down the hill is a bad step size for when you're actually in the flat river valley. And so the GA gives you a way of kind of adding some noise and jumping around the landscape with a controlled degree of randomness, and giving you a chance of finding, in our case, something like the distribution of valley solutions.
This is a nice analogy for my comment as well. If you were to ask two-dimensional topographic map, and you have x and y coordinates, and each of them is associated with a z value, which is how high the terrain is there, if you were to do a distribution of the values of the x's and of the y's, for all of those places in which you have valleys, you'd see nothing. You want the actual pairs of X and Y's. And there may be just two valleys, a few valleys, quite a few mountains, but you'd see nothing if you just gave the distribution. How did the X's and Y's are distributed in all of those places that are valleys? I think I've made my point.
Well, I think, you're right. What we have to do is look at the whole distribution, right? But
I have a question about the biology. So in the end, you had your diagram about the four clusters, some are fast, some are slow, and you have the various influences on each other. Now, of these genes, there are over 100 that are clusters and so on. Some of them have been known in spinal cord development and so on. I mean, did you actually show these to biologists? Did it make biological sense in some sense, or are these completely novel and you can't really validate it, say, against a neural network like a biologist who knows about this?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question.
If you showed which genes are influencing which and so on to a biologist who actually studies spinal cord development, does it make sense, or is it completely novel and you couldn't say anything about it?
Most of the genes that you showed there are pretty common.
Yeah, I mean this isn't. This was. I guess I had that on a slide somewhere, but I don't know where it's gone. This isn't actually our work, but the work of actually the people who took the data themselves, Roland Schomagy and his co-workers, and these clusters did at least roughly, associate naturally with appropriate biological function at different stages in development. So it's not something like you just get random looking lists of genes. It's something which is not biological nonsense.
Okay, I missed that.
Okay.